received by May 17th at 8 p.m. Postmarks do not count in Oregon. So get those ballots in. Thank you very much for that public service announcement from the Multnomah County elections. And let's listen to one little piece of little announcement, and then we're going to get to the dirt bag. It's 10:59 at KBOO Portland.
Dear KBOO members, as you may have heard, KBOO is currently in a strategic planning process to map out our next 3 years, what we'll focus on, what our goals will be, and how we will achieve these goals and best serve our mission. Our Strategic Planning Support Work Group is now looking for your input to build our vision for the next 3 years. There are two ways to participate. One, take 10 minutes and complete a survey to share your vision for KBOO's near future. The survey is on the KBOO website, but paper copies are also available at the station, and the Spanish version is coming soon. Two, sign up to join a focus group. There are three focus groups organized for May 9th and May 12th. Go to kboo.fm/KBOO Strategic Plan Survey to take the survey and learn more about the focus groups. Thank you for supporting your community radio station and for investing in KBOO's future.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW, and also by One Green World. It's a local nursery offering hard-to-find fruiting plants designed to help you grow your own food and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. To order plants or their 2015, maybe 2016 color catalog, their website is onegreenworld.com, or you can reach them by phone at 1-877-353-4028. Here comes the dirt bag.
Good morning. We've reached the second Wednesday of the month, and it's 11 o'clock. It's time for the dirt bag. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you, flying solo until noon. Well, Tammy's always with me, so. What I'm saying is Jim is off in Russia, I do believe. And he will be back next month for a report on that and what's going on in the orchard. Today, even without Jim, we've got a pretty good busy schedule, but I want to always give you the chance to ask questions, gardening questions, 503-231-8187. Our topic up first is composting. In the second half of the hour, I'm going to talk about swarming of bees. This is the season, and many of you may have seen swarms. It's quite interesting on what actually happens and why it happens. In between that, we've got the garden stumper having to do with Oregon agriculture and our plant of the month, lingonberries. Don't believe I've ever talked about lingonberries before. And we'll get to that up first. And our musical selections, my musical selections today, all have to do with kind of lingonberries in a very indirect manner. I'll explain when we start that. First, I do have one announcement about a tour, and this is not necessarily a gardening tour, but a tour of beehives. Tour de Hives, Portland Tour de Hives. And this is coming up in June, June 25th and 26th. It's a two-day event here. This is it's been going on for several years now with a 1 or 2 year break. And I've been on it. My hives have been on it, and I believe I'll be on it again this year. This year, it's a two-day event, and the timing is 1 to 4 on both Saturday and Sunday, and I believe the gardens that are on the Saturday tour are in Northeast Portland, and the ones on Sunday are all in Southeast Portland. $10 ticket will get you admission for both days, and you'll get a map, and so you can plan your route, and you know, of course, you can bike to these things. And of course, there's more than just beehives on display. That many have chickens or mason bees, and most have fine gardens too. So more information and purchase tickets at tourdehives.com, tourdehives.com. This is a fundraiser for Portland Urban Beekeepers Group, a nonprofit organization. I'm a member of that, but I think I can say that because it's a 501(c). And I'll just read you this a little bit here about some information that I have here. Some people go on Tour de Hives out of simple curiosity. Others are preparing to become beekeepers themselves. Portland novelist Lois Levine went on Tour de Hives in 2013 while researching a book set in medieval Italy in which one character was a beekeeper. Quote, "I just fell in love with what I saw. The sights, sounds, and smells of the hive were so powerful, the bees became a huge part of my novel and my life." End quote. She ended up with two hives in her yard, and she became an advocate on local beekeeping ordinances. So good for Lois. That's the Tour de Hives on June 25th and 26th. And golly, you know, most beekeepers are just fine, unassuming people and easy to approach and are wonderfully happy to talk about bees and beekeeping. So check that out. I'll give a reminder next month because we still have a month to go on that. All right. Our plant of the month are lingonberries. LINGONBERRY. Lingonberry. They wild lingonberries are found in more than 24 countries, I found out, but they're indigenous to Alaska, Canada, Scandinavia, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. They grow in sandy, northern, temperate, boreal forests, and which is why they're all up there north. But they do grow now in Oregon. I grow some. And that's a big field, about 450 species here. They're related to the blueberry and the cranberry. It's a perennial, beautiful plant. Shiny, small leaves, woody, evergreen, acid-loving shrub. Spreads by below-ground stems, rhizomes. The fruit is relatively small, maybe size of a raisin, different color. Bright red to dark red, strong flavored and tart. Nutritious and rich in antioxidants, anthocyanins, and flavonoids. They're hardy plants, as you might expect, growing in almost to the Arctic Circle there, and can survive freezing temperatures. But be warned that when freezing temperatures or frost occur during the flowering or fruiting, that the berry loss can be up to 50%. they've been noted to survive. Plants with ripe fruit have been noted to survive with down to 28 degrees Fahrenheit, and green fruit to 27 degrees. And I say this because they can bloom pretty early around here, but they do well in our maritime climate, and they have survived temperatures, just the plants themselves, down to 2 degrees. So pretty hardy lingonberries. And you can, if it's going to get colder than that, you can mulch them with straw. But they are an evergreen, so it's a nice-looking plant year-round. The fruit grows on one-year-old growth. We talked about this last month of where fruit appears on the plant. We didn't include lingonberries, but it's on the previous year's growth. And there are two bloom periods, which is kind of interesting, March to April and July to August. And the fruit ripens either in mid-August then or mid-October, depending on when they bloom there. One thing about lingonberries to keep in mind is that they do better with a pollinizer, another variety. They are self-fertile, but you'll have better yield and better sized berries if you have that pollinizer, another variety. And I believe One Green World does carry some species of lingonberries, and others do too. They do require insect pollination, bees, flies, bumblebees, butterflies, but wind does little to help the lingonberries. Where should they be planted? Well, you know, full sun is okay, but I've had mine in hot sun, and they did not get enough water, and they suffered during hot periods. So sun, but moist, and acid. They're related to blueberries and cranberries, which require an acid soil. Best time to plant is in the spring or the fall. You can buy them by roots, or find somebody with lingonberries and just dig some up during that time when there's plenty of moisture in the ground. This would not be a good time now. It's drying out very quickly here too. Plant the roots about 2 to 3 inches deep, or if you have plants, the normal manner there. So that's lingonberries. Lingonberries, they're very traditional in Swedish culture. But I don't know how many years I knew my grandmother, maybe 45, never saw a lingonberry in my Swedish-American grandmother's house. So she didn't grow up with it, but it's very traditional. I have a friend who is half Swedish, and they use lingonberries on a lot of things, even as a compote for meat. It's usually they're sweetened somehow in jams or jellies. You've probably had them at pancake places or at the, what's the Swedish store? IKEA will have little tiny jars. Pretty spendy things, but the main thing is they're a beautiful plant and grow easily. So, okay, now to our music. I want to explain this a little bit, all by the same artiste. And his name is Nils Landgren and the Funk Unit. And how does this tie into lingonberries, you may ask? Well, Nils is a Swedish trombone player. You heard of Nils, have you? No, Tammy says no, never heard of Nils. I don't blame you. But maybe after this you will. So these are all three funky things from Nils Landgren. The first one's called Walk Tall. It's actually a Nate Adderley piece, but Walk Tall. Nils Landgren. Well, maybe that gives you a little bit of appreciation of the trombone and what it can do. Seems like they're really not never in the front of the bands. Well, of course, Glenn Miller and all that, but these days, saxophone, trumpet, yeah. Not trombone so much, but it's a fine instrument, and I've played it for 50 years. All right. All right, we have a phone call. Barth.
Good morning.
Good morning, Barth.
Good morning, Gardener Guru. I have a random question. We've taken to drinking brewed coffee again. We didn't do that for a long time. And I have a rental property that I'm at, and there's a great deal of ivy on the edges of the backyard. And I've taken to tossing my grounds into the ivy. Am I doing something that is problematic or not?
You mean like fertilizing the ivy?
Yeah, well, I'm just, I know ivy is its own problem, and it's relatively contained where it is. But is this an issue just in terms of soil acidity or any other problems?
Generally,
I put it in my compost pile when I'm not feeling quite so lazy. So.
Uh-huh. Well, the thing is this kind of segues right into our composting topic, is that we don't want to give soil and compost, you know, too much of any one thing.
Right.
And so if you can't see the ivy anymore because of the coffee grounds, and this is just home brew.
Yeah, it's a small amount.
That would be fine. If you're getting buckets, 5-gallon buckets at a time from the coffee stores, then that might be problematic. But having said that, I've known someone who had a worm bin, and really the only thing they put in there, at least as I remember this, was coffee grounds. And the worm bin was just chock full of coffee grounds and worms. It was one of these that was maybe a foot and a half tall, or maybe even more, and 2 or 3 feet wide, or 2 by 3 feet or so, and it was just full of coffee grounds. So maybe the worms liked it. And, you know, really, there's probably not a whole lot of caffeine left in brewed coffee grounds, and it's just kind of, I don't know. There might
plant
be more
material
than sawdust.
Yeah.
Right. But I should look into that and find out what the nutritive content of spent, can you have any other type of coffee grounds? So I don't know. But I'd say you're a little bit there. No, there's no problem at all. I mean, the bigger problem would be the ivy, but you said the right thing, that it's relatively contained.
Right. I don't let it get over the fence or up the fence. And
good. And don't let it bloom either,
so
birds can eat it and spread it.
Yeah, this stuff doesn't seem to flower.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Okay.
Very
good.
Thanks, Brian. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's... like I said, that leads us right into our topic of composting. And if you have any questions on composting or what's going on in your garden, 503-231-8187. I thought one way to address the composting would be to talk about different methods of it first, from the easiest to more involved. And I don't know which is the easiest one, either if you have lawn clippings, just leave the clippings on the lawn. That's pretty easy. If you're going to mow the lawn, leave it there. This time of year, there's really no reason to bag your clippings. And in fact, if you're like me, that has a freedom lawn, actually, I don't really have much lawn anymore, but I do take care of a lawn that is what I call a freedom lawn, that any species of plant that can live below my lawnmower's blade gets to live. You know, so there's other things besides grass there, and, you know, weeds. And occasionally they'll go to seed. And if you collect those clippings and then put them into your compost pile, and it's not a hot compost pile, well, you could be having little weedling seedlings coming up in your compost pile. So it's not a good thing. It's just a lot easier to leave the clippings on the lawn. It does not contribute to thatch build up. In fact, if you mow a little more frequently, it will actually help control your thatch, in that it provides organic matter that can then work to compost itself, and it'll break down the thatch. Thatch is just the dead rhizomes of grass. They grow by rhizomes too, just like the lingonberries we talked about, underground roots, if you will. And they just pile up and die, and leaving the grass clippings on does not contribute to that at all. It's just a natural part of that. But it's why some people are interested in thatching. Or is that dethatching? Is it boning or deboning? The English language, so complex. So that's one easy way to compost. Another quite easy way is to let somebody else do it. And that is to say, put it into the green cart. Let the city take it away. They take it to a commercial composter, and then you can buy the compost back. That seems a little back-asswards, but it's a good enough product, and it can be done. Moving on to maybe a little bit more effort involved on your part is just to pile it up someplace in your yard. If you don't absolutely need a bin, you can just pile up leaves or grass in an unused part of your garden and just let it compost on its own. I would caution you against putting in food scraps in those type of compost piles without bins, because it does become a lot more attractive to birds and rodents and raccoons and possums. Although, to tell you the truth, I've never had a problem with possums or raccoons in my compost. No, Tammy says no, she hasn't either. So moving on, then, think about a bin. And this can be just a one bin. It can be simple. Four pallets wired together, or a circle of wire fencing of some type. 2 to 3 feet in diameter, and just pile up things there. If you just pile up leaves, which is not a bad thing to do at all, you'll end up eventually with a material that we sometimes call leaf mold, which is the kind of the consistency of coffee grounds, and is a wonderful amendment to your garden. Very rich in micronutrients, won't have much nitrogen in there, but pound for pound, good composted leaves have twice as many nutrients as composted manure, with the exception of nitrogen, which is a big part of a nutrient need in the garden. So you can, from there, move to, which makes it, if you have just these enclosures, if you will, it makes it a little harder to turn. But if you're just putting in leaves, there's no reason to turn them. It's hard to do it, and there's no reason to, but it'll take 2 to 3 years. So you might be sacrificing some valuable garden space for that. But if you're piling up all sorts of yard debris in there, then the opening is big enough that you may very well be able to turn it. More on turning in just a bit. From the one-bin system, we might go to a two-bin system, where you can pile up stuff on one side for a while and then stop adding material to that and add materials to the bin right next to it, or another bin, so that your first pile can finish its composting process without being having more stuff added to it or turned into it, and thereby kind of contaminating is not the right word, but it's you're introducing uncomposted stuff into the composting stuff, so it makes it harder to use the compost. And at the other end, then, the most effort would be the three-bin system, the Cadillac of composters, because with this, it makes it easier to turn. But, of course, turning in itself can be somewhat arduous. But I kind of like it. I mean, I don't mind a little hard work. And I do like to see the steaming piles of compost. And I'll just take a little branch here to say there are what we call tumbler-type compost bins, where the compost is is right down the middle on its axis, and you can so it makes it easy to turn it. It's on a way to you can turn the bin with a crank or just your hand, and it makes it very easy to turn. But I'll have to admit that I'm not real satisfied with the product that comes out of there. The times that I've done, and I've tried it half a dozen times, they all turn out the same, and that's the product is kind of clods rather than nice friable compost, finished compost. It's a good word, friable. And if you have a specific problem like rodents, then this is a pretty good way to deal with that, because it's off the ground. There's not as many openings, and you can screen those openings pretty well. It's a drawback, too, that you don't have many openings. But it's out there. It's a solution to one or two problems, a good solution. And I would encourage you to explore that if you have those conditions. But back to the three-bin system. Oftentimes, the plans when you're making these three-bin systems will have three equal-sized bins. I recommend having the first bin, where you'll be putting your raw material, if you will, twice as big as the last bin. So, you know, have it 4, 3, and 2 feet wide, because the compost loses a lot of volume, and by having the a bigger bin, it only makes sense. You're kind of just wasting space otherwise. Now, why would we be interested in turning? Because we can speed up the composting process. Tammy tells me we have a phone call. Yes? Okay, and I'll come back to that, how we can speed up the composting process. Okay, Jack.
And try your call again.
Oh, we lost Jack. Jack can call back, perhaps. Okay. Good morning, Nat. You're with the Dirt Bag.
Now, I learned a lot from this. But,
there we are. Go ahead, Nat.
Okay, so thanks for the show. This is great. It's so nice to grow your own food and knowing how to do it is half the battle.
Indeed.
Not more. But I noticed that most people's compost bins are kind of like fruit fly incubators, because they've got these little slits in them.
Yeah.
So the flies can go in and out. I just wanted to make a suggestion for people to get some screen and fill those holes. What I do is I cut out a patch of screen, and then I take a torch or a heat gun, and then you heat up the plastic around the rim of the screen. You just push it into the plastic, and then you can stop those flies from coming and going and breeding like crazy.
Good suggestion.
And the other thing is, it seems like most of the compost bins that I see out in the Hood River area, since we get so hot and dry, they just dry out. So the other thing that I've done is I tap into my irrigation sprinkler system with one of those little drip nozzles, drill a hole through the side of the thing, and then or towards the top, and then just let it drip in when my garden gets watered. So that my compost bin is like full of worms and stuff. So
yeah, which worms are about 90% water or more, so they need a moist environment. And I'll get to the what the ideal components of a compost bin are too, or a compost.
Yeah, the ones that they give away out here are just fruit fly incubators, and every time I open the lid, there's just this swarm of fruit flies, and so I have to just open it up, throw the stuff in and close it right away. I mean, it's like within 2 seconds, but there's still the swarm of fruit flies that come out.
I heard a story a couple of days ago on, I think it was Here and Now on NPR.
Mm-hmm.
About
Navigating Pasteurized Radio.
About a woman who took it upon herself to rehabilitate injured hummingbirds.
Oh.
And so she would purposefully mash up bananas and let them start composting or rotting, so they would attract fruit flies, so the hummingbirds would have something to eat. So there's your solution to too many fruit flies.
get
those hummingbirds around there. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, we think hummingbirds just eating nectar, but no, at least half their meal are meat, like
good for them.
Fruit flies.
Awesome.
So, well, Nat, you've done a fair amount of thinking on solving your problems with compost pile. Good,
yeah,
good job.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Thanks for the call and thanks for the suggestions.
You bet.
Okay. Well, let's see here. Let's do our next Nils Landgren piece. This is called "Ouch." Woo. And then we'll come back and finish up composting and get to the garden stumper. So, Nils Landgren, "Ouch." while cutting off our Swedish trombonist Nils Landgren. That's called Ouch. Well, let's head into our garden stumper here. And boy, this is just a great little trifold that I got offline about from the Oregon Department of Agriculture here about our top commodities. So stay tuned for that. Let's get our theme going. We'll come back with the garden stumper. Okay, well, you've got four chances here to get an answer here. And what I'm looking for here is that according to this Oregon Department of Agriculture publication from 2014, I think that's the last real value that they have, I'm looking for the first or second highest grossing vegetable. This is by dollar value. The first or second highest grossing vegetable crop and or fruit crop in Oregon in 2014. So there's going to be two vegetables and two fruits here. Just give me one of those, and we'll eventually get to all of them. There's some other interesting information here that I found surprising, if you will. For example, the type of farms in 2014, individuals... There's four different types: individual, partnership, incorporated, and corporate farms, if you will, and other, cooperatives, estate trusts, or institutional. Far and away, the type of farm is farmed by just an individual, maybe a family. 84.3% of the farms in Oregon are run by individuals. Incredible. Like when Jim Gilbert, when he owned One Green World, well, he still owns his wholesale farm. He was an individual, so he was one of those things there. 84.3%. Corporate farms in Oregon, only 7.2%. Now, this is another interesting thing, that the age of the principal operator, 70 or over, is the highest percentage here, 21.7%. And Jim would also be in that group, as I think about it here. Average age of operator? Tammy, what do you think? Oh, boy, she doesn't know. No guess.
No clue.
Younger than me, 59.6.
Wow.
Yeah, that's getting up there. That's why there's a movement to get some young blood in there. So under 25, only 0.3%.
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah, the biggest percentage-wise, besides the 70 and over, is the 60 to 64 at 17%. So all double-digit above 50%. So, and then single-digit below years of age, I should have said. Below 50, just single digits. So isn't that interesting? Okay, do we have any? Yeah, I didn't even give the phone number yet. 503-231-8187. Now we're looking for the first or second highest grossing vegetable or fruit in Oregon in 2014. So I'll give you one that it's not. Okay, how's that? For example, raspberries. That is not in the top. Now, there's some other interesting information on this here, that the national ranking of Oregon in agricultural production in 2014. Speaking of blackberries, we produce 100%, we being the state of Oregon, 100% of the blackberries in the United States. Also, boysenberries, hazelnuts, and raspberries. 100% come from Oregon. But there's also some number one, the rank that we produce the most of any state, and that includes ryegrass, orchard grass, crimson clover, fescue seed, sugar beets for seed, red clover seed, potted florist azaleas, Christmas trees. Okay, peppermint were number two. Anyway, let's move on there. But we're still looking for the top grossing vegetable or fruit. Maybe that's going to stump everybody. All right, so coming back to compost here a little bit. Why do we turn compost? We turn it essentially to speed up the process, the composting process. Now, I'm fond of saying that we can speed up the process and we can slow it down, but we cannot stop it. So if you're going to try composting, you're going to be successful. Now, it may take a couple of years, or maybe it'll get stinky, which I'll get to in just a moment on what we don't want to do. But you just can't stop the composting process. And of course, unless you're in a complete vacuum, and that's not going to happen. Here are the components for an ideal compost pile, so the compost pile will heat up. Why do we want hot compost? Because it kills virtually all the pathogens and weed seeds and diseases. That's if the temperature gets above 135 degrees. I've stuck a thermometer in one of my hot compost piles some years ago, and it was 170. You can burn yourself on that. That's almost too hot. But so how do you get to those temperatures? And let me just say right off the bat here that I might talk to a group of gardeners, and maybe only 5% have hot compost piles. Maybe not even that. I don't have a hot compost going at this time. So don't feel bad if you don't have a hot compost pile. You'll just have what we call a cold pile that either gets turned or doesn't get turned. And so rather than having compost in 3 to 6 months, it might take 9 to 14 months before you have compost. You can speed up the process by putting in more effort, or you can just slow it down by doing nothing. So here are the components here for a hot compost pile. For one, we want to have the right ratio, if you will, of the materials that we're putting in there, either carbon or nitrogen. We think of a product as either having a relatively high amount of carbon or a relatively high amount of nitrogen. And the greatest examples of the high carbon content ones are leaves. A high nitrogen component would be grass, two very common compost components. Keep that thought, though, and we're going to go to the phone to see if we have a question or an answer. Okay. Good morning, Barb. Good morning, Barb. You're with the Dirtbag.
Yeah, hi. I'm a supporter from Corvallis. I would love to know more about worm bins.
Okay. I will.
Where to get a worm bin, and can you buy worms?
Yes, is the answer to the second part.
It's such a strange thing to buy worms.
Well, or if you find a friend who has a worm bin, then they sometimes can just give you a handful of those. And I should say that my worm bin has been in continuous operation for more than 25 years, a quarter of a century.
Oh, really?
So these are the worms that I have now are the descendants of those original worms that I remember picking out of my compost pile.
Oh, my God. That's so amazing.
So if you have just a regular yard debris compost and you end up with worms in it towards the end of the composting process, and most of the time one does, you can use those worms. Those are the worms that would work, the red wigglers, or manure worms are sometimes called Icinia fetida is the Latin name. And there are companies that seem to come and go about offering worms for sale. And I know Metro here in the Portland region, the Metro recycling hotline, 503-234-3000. They keep a list of people that have worms, and you could call that number, and I doubt they would have somebody have a listing of somebody in Corvallis, but they would give you a number, and you could call them and see, maybe they'll mail them to you, or you could come up and get them, or whatever.
Maybe Master Gardeners here would.
Yeah.
They probably would know,
Some would know there. I'm sure somebody would have them there. Okay. And a gardening club probably would have number or names, too. So.
Yeah.
And for the nuts and bolts of worm composting here, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but we'll talk about it right now. And essentially that these worms that I just mentioned, the red wigglers, are surface dwellers. So the bins that you asked about where you can get them, and you can buy worm bins, and Metro has plans on their website. You could, I don't know if it's metro.org or metrooregon.org, but you'll find it. There would be plans for worm bins. And you, or you could buy plastic containers, Rubbermaid or whatever other brand names there are of those. And the key, if you're making it yourself, is to make sure that there is drainage, particularly if it's a plastic bin. Plastic is good because it's not going to compost like wood will, but you need to drill holes in it for drainage. And kind of what I recommend is to get two and nest one inside the other, so the bottom one is will just catch the leachate that comes out, and then you'll have a lid too to put on it. But so what we're looking for are shallow containers, not garbage can shape, but you know, like Rubbermaid containers that have a lot of surface area. And worms need bedding, as we call it bedding. And in the literature, they'll recommend newspaper, ripped newspaper that you dampen and start out. And it's not really their bedding, but they will use it. I mean, they just need a home, a medium to live in to begin with, rather than their own poop, which is the worm compost. But I greatly prefer leaves as bedding or straw. And it's fine to use some newspaper, but my experience has been that newspaper bedding in worm bins ends up in the vermicompost pretty gummy. And, you know, it just sticks to your gloves or your fingers or whatever, and it's hard to spread and use. But boy, not with the leaves. It's just great. So I stockpile leaves either in bags or in 5-gallon buckets, just cram as many in as I can and then parcel them out through the winter and summer. And how much can you feed a worm bin? Well, the rule of thumb is 1 pound of food per square foot of surface area per week. And that also might be per pound of bees. So at the beginning, you're not going to be able to put as much food in, or you'll be farming fruit flies too. But okay. So if you had, you know, a 2x2 bin, then you, eventually you could be putting 4 pounds of food, worm food, into the bin. And there's books on it, and certainly lots of information online. And yeah, it's you know, they're pretty easy to take care of, and you can go weeks without feeding them. Even they just won't breed as much.
What happens in the winter? Do they?
Well, it depends where it is. You know, I wouldn't leave it out just in the open, although it certainly can. But the bigger the bin is, the more. Well, when it gets cold, bees will cluster in a ball in the middle. And if they only have a container the size of that ball, then there's no way they can survive because the cold will penetrate. But if it's in the middle of a 2x2 bin, then they've got some insulation. Mine is in my basement, my unfinished basement. So it's pretty temperate there year round. But their ideal temperature for worms is about 70 degrees. But you know, 40 to 80 is fine too. But if they're outside, you know, try to put it in a sheltered area. All right, that's my primer on on worm composting with worms. And I was hoping to get to that anyway. So good question.
Thanks so much.
You bet.
Have a show.
Great. Okay, so still no answers. Is that right? All right. Nobody wants to take a guess on what the first or second highest grossing vegetable or fruit is. Well, I can start giving some away here. Should I give the first ones? No, I'll give the second ones. That'll be less. Okay, so in the case of vegetables, the highest grossing vegetable by dollars, worth $106 million a year. This is the first one. No, the second one, didn't I say? Second one. Okay, the second one. $28 million a year in Oregon, sweet corn. Who would have thunk that? No, I wouldn't have either. Okay, and then moving on to the second amount of fruit, which fruit, this might be kind of surprising, but not really now that you think about it, grapes for wine. We are becoming a destination there for, I mean, just a very well known for high quality wines. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're still looking for the highest production of vegetable or fruit in Oregon. Okay, Tammy, are you ready for our last Nils Landgren? She's ready. Okay, this is one of the trademarks of Nils Landgren is that he plays a red trombone. It's custom made for him by, I believe, Yamaha. But this is called Red Horn. Swedish trombonist Nils Landgren to wrap up our musical selections today in homage to the lingonberry, which grows natively in Sweden. It grows other places too, but that's what I know most about. Okay, we've got some answers to the garden stumper. Good morning. What do you got?
Christmas trees.
Oh, that's a good guess, but that's not it. Let's see where Christmas trees rank in... let's see here. I don't know if I'm going to find that quickly here. Oh, yes. Christmas trees is the 12th of the commodities. That's right. Here's the number one.
I thought that I had heard that Christmas trees were the largest grossing crop. Well, I guess I'm wrong.
Yeah, but it's up. I mean, it's pretty darn close. I mean, it's in the ballpark of if it's not a, you know, wheat or grass seed or something like that. But here's number one and two is cattle and calves is number one. And number two is greenhouse and nursery stock. So Christmas trees is 12th.
Wow.
And the okay, that's it.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay, we got another guess. Okay, what you got for me?
Cranberries.
Cranberries rank in, let's see, they're not even in the top there. Not in the top 20.
Huh.
Oh, but they do... Nope, they're not even there, but they are about almost $11 million, cranberries. That's pretty good. It's one of our crops there. Nope, okay, but good guess.
Thanks.
Yep. Let's see. Cranberries, we are the fourth highest national state as far as cranberries, but we produce only 6%, but they are the highest quality. Yes, nice and red, well pleased. Okay, Rick left us. Okay. Good morning, Rick. Got a question?
Yeah, question about grapes. That ain't too far off topic.
Heck no.
I just wondered, I got a lot of grapes, but wondered the best way to trellis them and prune them. I pruned them back last year to like maybe four of those big big leader branches.
Okay. Well, the rule of thumb with grape pruning is that you're going to take off 90% of last year's growth. 90%. That's a lot, because they tend to way overproduce. Then the second thing to keep in mind is that you only want to leave, 50 to 75 buds per plant. That's to get the highest quality fruit. Now, you'll get lots of fruit if you leave more on there, but they'll be smaller and they won't be as good a quality. The other thing as far as pruning is that it's okay to prune even after the grapes are on and forming. And in fact, if you prune off some of the leaves, you increase the sun and the airflow around them, so you'll have fewer disease problems on the grapes. Is that making sense?
Real easy. I never had any problems at all, and I never.
It's
like you got to water them or fertilize them. They just.
Yep.
All you got to do is keep cutting them back.
It depends what varieties you're growing. Some of the standard Concord and whatnot, they pretty much just grow and grow and grow. But if you want some of the others, then it takes more effort. What variety do you grow?
Is it just purple slipskin?
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's what I just got. My friend had it growing at his house. Robbie had them, and his landlord said he got to get rid of them. So
He
pruned them way back, and we dug up the root ball and planted it at my place.
Well, it sounds like you're doing okay then if you're not having fungal problems and you're getting grapes. But, they just put on a lot of growth, and so if they're not in the way, that the problem with me is that, I put them on a trellis and then they start growing down and I walk into them, or they latch onto my laundry line or grow up into a tree.
I'm thinking about putting a trellis in there because they're kind of growing all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Usually they do best on a trellis.
Is that best? I was thinking there's a fence there. Maybe I was thinking about putting a couple of pieces of angle iron on there that are sort of at a 45 bend and
maybe
two or three lines of wire.
You can stake them or tie them to anything, and they just keep growing. So you'll be whatever you choose to do as a trellis, they'll work. But make it secure, not just any little wood, a 1x2 is not going to hold up grapes.
Yeah, I found that out last year. I built one, and the grapes were so heavy. I don't know, it might have been 500 pounds. I don't know.
Yeah.
And it busted it up.
All right.
So the best way is to just, put them on something real solid with one or two wires to grow across?
Yeah, or bars across. I have wood, 4x4 posts, four by four posts, and then 2x4s on their sides, so they're strong, and then train them across that way. But they're overhead, 8 feet above, so I can walk underneath them.
You put down like 4x4s, maybe every 4 to 6 feet apart, and then on top of it.
Mine are 12 feet apart or something like that.
Oh, and then you have 2x4s running across the top.
Right. That's all. I got to wrap up here.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah, let's see
you could just do that, have 4x4s and a 2x4 on top, and they'll grow across that, or do you...
Yeah, well, you'll have to train them and tie them to it.
Oh, okay. Just tie it to the 2x4.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
I can figure that out.
You bet.
Thanks.
Okay, you bet.
I like your show.
Great.
It's good.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Okay, got some quick answers here. Omar.
I was guessing apples.
Apples. Nope, sorry. That ranks up there, but it's not it.
Okay.
Thanks. Hal, what's your guess? Hal is gone. Oh, he's there. I just can't hear you there. Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to say cannabis.
Well, in 2014, it wasn't part of our commodity crop, but it could be now.
Okay. I didn't know we had a year on it.
Yeah. Well, that's the last that I have the figures for here.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Well.
Yeah. That probably is the number one. Even then, it was probably the number one. Okay, I'm just going to tell you here because we're out of time here. The number one vegetable, storage onions. Who would have thunk? And pears. Now, that's knowable because we grow a lot of pears in the Hood River Valley and whatnot. So, okay, no taco swarm today. Thanks for the calls. Tammy, you're the greatest. And Jim will be back, as will I, in 4 weeks. This is The Dirt Bag. This is Glenn Andreessen. That's my story so far.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, May 11th, 2016. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Multnomah County Patrol.